From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we examine the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising, with Israeli journalist Ehud Ya'ari. He says the continuing rebellion has changed the balance of power in the Palestinian leadership, and it's forced Israelis to consider how holding on to the occupied territories is threatening their democracy. Also today, writer Jessica Hagedorn talks about growing up in the Philippines. She's used that country's mix of cultures and classes as the backdrop for her new novel. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new release of works by 20th century composer Leon Kirshner. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone looks at the many faces of impressionist Louise Duart. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A caller claiming to represent Colombia's drug traffickers has claimed responsibility for today's murder of presidential candidate Carlos Pizarro. Pizarro, a former guerrilla who joined the presidential race about a month ago, was machine-gunned to death on an airliner reportedly carrying more than 100 people. Police say the assassin was immediately killed by Pizarro's bodyguards. An anonymous caller told a Colombian radio network today that the killing was ordered by drug traffickers and that Pizarro was targeted in a lottery with the names of other candidates. The woman who tried to kill the West German politician Oscar Lafontaine has been transferred to a psychiatric institution near Cologne. Lafontaine survived the assassination attempt, and doctors are hopeful he'll fully recover. Deirdre Berger reports.
At a press conference in Cologne, police officials say 42-year-old Adelheld Streidel is mentally disturbed. Police officer Reinhard Fischer said Streidel told officers she wanted to kill a politician in order to be put to trial and get into the press. She also said she wanted to tell the court about factories in Europe where human beings are manipulated. Neighbors in her hometown of Bad Neuenahr said Streidel had repeatedly tried to buy a gun in recent months. Doctors in Cologne say the knife that Streidel thrust into LaFontaine's throat last night missed a major artery by 1 millimeter. Social Democratic Party officials in Bonn today said LaFontaine will remain their candidate for chancellor in December parliamentary elections. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger reporting.
The leaders of France and West Germany today called on the government of Lithuania to rescind its pro-independence laws and suspend its drive for independence. French President François Mitterrand and West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl said the Baltic Republic should meet Moscow's demands and clear the way for negotiations on the independence issue. Three Palestinians were killed in Israel's occupied territories today and more than 100 injured in one of the most violent days this year. NPR's Linda Gradstein has this report from Jerusalem.
In the Jabalia refugee camp in the Gaza Strip, not far from the new Jewish settlement of Dugit. Thousands of Palestinians marched in a demonstration. Security sources said they began throwing stones at Israeli soldiers and a riot broke out. Two Palestinians were killed and over 100 injured. In a second incident in the West Bank town of Kabatia, another youth was killed in a crash and several injured. The army said 12 soldiers were also hurt. The violence came on the first day of the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr, and after PLO leader Yasser Arafat appeared on Jordanian television and asked Palestinians to step up the struggle against Israeli occupation. The army also put the largest West Bank city of Nablus under curfew to avoid violence there. This is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 10 points to close at 2,676.58. This is NPR. The leader of rebel forces in Liberia said today that he's ready to strike at the nation's capital of Monrovia. Charles Taylor told reporters today that his forces have control of an important northern county and plan to move into the capital with a minimum loss of life. Taylor's threat came one day after Liberian President Samuel Doe vowed to crush the rebellion. Doe himself seized power in a bloody coup in 1980. He said he'd wipe out the rebels unless they surrender in 2 weeks. The House Foreign Affairs Committee today voted to cut U.S. military aid to El Salvador in half and funnel that money instead into humanitarian assistance. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
The bill amended in committee today includes $85 million a year in U.S. aid to the El Salvadoran army. The changes made today would make future military aid to El Salvador conditional on the government's negotiating in good faith with the rebels and investigating last year's murder of six Jesuit priests. It would also restore military aid if leftist rebels continued to receive weapons shipments from outside of the country. The administration strongly disapproved of the committee's move today, and Republicans on the committee said the changes gave legitimacy to the leftist rebels in El Salvador. The committee's action today may only serve to stake out the Democrats' position on El Salvador, because next week House Democratic leaders will sit down with Secretary of State James Baker to begin trying to work out a bipartisan U.S. policy toward El Salvador. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The racketeering trial of Imelda Marcos was interrupted this afternoon when the former Philippine First Lady suffered an attack of high blood pressure. The trial was postponed for the remainder of the day. During this morning's session, a U.S. Customs officer testified he came across a case containing more than 50 pounds in gold bars when the Marcoses arrived in exile in Hawaii in 1986. The case was inscribed, "To my husband on our 24th wedding anniversary." I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The ongoing Palestinian uprising, known as the Intifada, erupted in December of 1987. It started in the largest refugee camp in the Gaza Strip and spread to the West Bank. Both territories have been occupied by Israel since 1967. My guest, Ehud Ya'ari, is the co-author of a new book about the Intifada. He says that neither the Israelis nor the PLO expected the rebellion to last. But the longer it drags on and the more casualties it claims, the more distrust it generates between Palestinians and Israelis. Ehud Ya'ari covers Middle East affairs for Israeli TV. His co-author, Zev Schiff, is the military correspondent for the Israeli daily Haaretz. Their new book is called Intifada. I asked Ya'ari about the current status of the Intifada.
Well, I would say that we have reached a point where both parties, Israelis and Palestinians, have exhausted most of their potential fighting each other. That is, the Israelis will face a lot of difficulty trying to crush the Intifada completely and wipe the Intifada off the face of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I don't think we can do it. And if I may add, I don't think we should do it. And the Palestinians, I think, have realized by now that they cannot wipe out the Israeli army from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Probably they cannot wipe out Israeli settlements from these territories. And both parties are probably very close by now, in spite of the fact that it doesn't seem to be so very often. I think that both parties are very close to realization that they have to sit down and try to discuss the matter in a more proper manner.
Let's talk a little bit about the background of the Intifada. You say that Israel initially said that the uprising was inspired by Syria and the PLO, that the Syria and the PLO were behind it. But you contest that. You say this was really a rebellion of the poor.
Yes. My colleague Zev Schiff and myself, we have reached the conclusion that the power of the Intifada, the energy of the Palestinian uprising, stemmed from a simple, well-known rebellion of the poor. The poorest of the poor amongst the Palestinians, we call them the angry proletariat of Israel. Only at a later stage were people who are loyal advocates of the PLO able to transform the uprising into a politically motivated and directed revolt. But it took at least 2 months before this was possible. And I think both politicians on the Palestinian side of the fence, also politicians on the Israeli side of the fence, are very reluctant to admit that the main reason for the outbreak of the Intifada were socioeconomic. That is, the distress, the humiliation, the poor economic conditions of many of the Palestinians in the territories. And for example, during the first wave of demonstrations back in December 87, most of the people detained in the streets by the Israeli security forces were not known to the interrogators, were not known to our intelligence. And the officers were simply faced in the detention camp with people they didn't know, and they didn't expect them to be participants of such violent demos. And when they started talking to them and ran a few questionnaires, they reached the conclusion that people mainly felt that they were being humiliated under the occupation, that their life conditions were unbearable, and not because they wanted to demonstrate for a certain national aspiration. That is, people took to the street because they felt that their life were not good enough, not because they felt that they have to support Mr. Arafat's call for an independent Palestinian state. At the same time, you will find it difficult to get any Israeli politician to admit that life of the many Palestinians under what we used to consider a benign occupation were so difficult as to get people to take to the streets. So it is easy, just as well, to Israeli politicians, all shades of the political spectrum, to blame foreign powers, PLO, Syria, Iran, whatever, for what happened during the Intifada.
Well, you think that Arafat initially underrated the uprising and that that was a grave mistake. And then when he realized how important it was and how much energy was behind it, he tried to make it seem like the PLO was leading the uprising. How did he try to get control?
The first few weeks of the Intifada were almost pathetic as in what concerns Arafat. I mean, the guy was on the telephone, him and his lieutenants, but also him personally, trying to locate who were the people leading the demonstrations on the streets, especially in the Gaza Strip. He didn't know, just as the Israeli intelligence didn't recognize this new gallery of faces on the streets. However, through an initiative taken without reference to Arafat, by local activists of one faction of the PLO, which is the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a small neo-Marxist group with an elitist approach to Palestinian politics, these people initiated the formation of what they called at the time the Unified National Command and started issuing leaflets giving instructions to the population on how to behave and how to carry on with this rebellion. Arafat have managed, after 2 or 3 months, to maintain, to impose, or I would rather say to reimpose, PLO supremacy and patronage over the Unified Command, in spite of the fact that a strong tension and strain existed, still does, between the insiders, that is, the Palestinians on the inside the territories occupied by Israel, and the outside leadership of the PLO. The fact that the Israeli Security Service was able, by March 88, that is, 3 or 4 months after the outbreak of the Intifada, to arrest most of the leading members of the Unified Command, made it easier for Arafat to take control and prove to the insiders that they have to listen to the PLO Tunis, to the leadership which is outside Israel, because they cannot sustain and they cannot escape arrest by the Israelis. So it's a very strange situation where, in fact, the Israelis, by arresting and crushing the Unified Command in the West Bank, were helping their enemy, Mr. Arafat, regained control over the population.
My guest is Israeli journalist Ehud Ya'ari, and he's co-authored a new book called Intifada, The Palestinian Uprising, Israel's Third Front. How much control did Islamic fundamentalist groups have?
During the Intifada, we have witnessed a sharp transformation of the Islamic fundamentalists in the territories. These people traditionally, historically, emphasized education, prayers, not political action. However, under the pressure of the Intifada, with the tens of thousands of people streaming into the streets and trying to attack the Israeli army bases and Israeli convoys, trying to block the roads and barricade inside the villages, etc., the fundamentalists found that they have to join the wave and try to take the lead. So the main organization that was formed during the Intifada, and this is a new phenomenon, is Hamas, the initials for the Islamic resistance movement. And I would say that by now, If a poll was taken in the territories, I believe that these people would easily gain about a third of the vote, which is something to bear in mind if at any point from now on we are going to have elections in the territories as suggested by the Israelis, accepted by the Palestinians, and now sponsored by Secretary Baker. Islamic fundamentalism has become a very important phenomena in Middle East politics by and large. And if we try to take a good look at what's happening to the Palestinians, then we will see that whenever we had elections in the past year, that is, elections for the Jordanian parliament, 80% of the Palestinians in Jordan voted for fundamentalist candidates. In Israel itself, we had recently two rounds of election. One was for municipal elections and the other was for the trade unions. And in both, the results, the score won by the fundamentalists was quite impressive. So there is a situation now that the PLO supremacy amongst the Palestinians is being contested by the Islamic fundamentalists. And my own personal feeling is that the longer it takes us to reach the negotiations table, the easier it's going to be for the Islamic fundamentalists to gain more following in the territories.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the impression I get from your book is that you think the PLO rhetoric is more against the government of Israel, Israeli policies, whereas the Islamic fundamentalist rhetoric is more anti-Jewish.
That's true. There are very strong anti-Semitic undertones to the Islamic fundamentalist literature. They have, for example, they have published their covenant, which is supposed to be the platform, the overall political platform of the Islamic movement, the Palestinian Islamic movement. And a great part of it is devoted and dedicated to quotations from the protocols of the Elders of Zion. In their brochures, in their leaflets, which are very often distributed in the territories, the struggle is portrayed as a struggle between the good Muslims and bad Jews. The PLO has been, until recently, very careful to portray the struggle as a confrontation between two nations, and as of last year, the PLO is taking the position that they are willing, in principle, to accept the right of Israel to exist as a Jewish state. But under the pressure of the Islamic rhetoric and the propaganda, recently I have noticed some, for the first time, by the way, some anti-Semitic literature being published by the PLO. Most recently, an article which I thought was outrageous, an article which denied the Holocaust during World War II. And I think that the PLO are under a lot of pressure because of the advances made by the Islamics. And sometimes, because they fear confrontation, because Mr. Arafat believes that he should prevent an open split amongst the Palestinians, they submit to them, and the PLO is bowing their heads to the Islamics instead of debating them openly.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Ehud Ja'ari. He's the Middle East Affairs Correspondent for Israel Television, and he's co-authored with Zev Schiff the new book Intifada, the Palestinian Uprising. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We've talked a little bit about how the leadership has changed in the occupied territories during the Intifada. Let's take a look at what's happened in the Israeli government, in the Israeli military,
during the Intifada. I think a lot of people in America were very disturbed reading the reports of how the Israel military was behaving during the early part of the Intifada. Reports of clubbing, reports of shootings with plastic bullets, but reports that made it sound like there was an element of sadism being carried out as well, that somehow the Israeli response to the Intifada was bringing out a certain sadistic impulse on the part of some people in the military. Would you respond to that?
I think you are correct. I think we had the excesses, few of them with sort of sadistic overtones. It happens when an army of tens of thousands of soldiers is facing hundreds of thousands Palestinians in an uneven confrontation. In many cases, the Israeli soldiers found themselves being attacked by big mobs of Palestinians, and they were prevented from shooting by order. So their response tended to be to club, and there was an instruction given at the time to this effect. I think that it took few weeks before the Israelis, both the simple soldiers and the defense minister Rabin himself, to realize that clubbing was not the right answer to the situation where it was impossible and forbidden to shoot civilians. The Intifada as a whole is an impossible situation for an army to cope with. The army was not equipped and not trained to cope with such an open rebellion by masses of civilians. And it took a lot of time before the army had devised some tactics in order to prevent these frequent clashes between the Palestinians and the soldiers.
The Israeli military was called on to use clubs, to use plastic bullets, to shoot into crowds of civilians with men, women, and children. Did you find, Ehud Yahari, that the military was willing or reluctant to play this new role during the Intifada?
No doubt the Israeli military, by and large, was very reluctant to follow the advice which was given to the generals by some of the more reckless ministers in the Israeli government to disperse the Palestinian demonstrations with live ammunition. There were several confrontations between some of our hardline right-wing ministers and the chief of staff and the generals in command of the Southern Command and the Central Command, that is the areas where the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are, to the point that the chief of staff at one cabinet session offered his resignation. We have a very bizarre situation in Israel where usually it's the generals who are the hot-headed, and the civilian ministers have to restrain them. This was the case when the French were fighting in Algeria. I think partly the case when you Americans were fighting in Vietnam. It was not the case in Israel. In Israel, the case was that young generals had to restrain older ministers and prevent the Intifada from becoming a bloodbath. And I think that every Israeli should take to our credit the fact that we are probably one of the only nations that is trying its officers and soldiers for excesses, for brutal behavior in the territories whenever this occurs, very, very shortly after it takes place. That is, we don't wait for this war, and the Intifada is a kind of war. We don't wait for this war to be over in order to try those who are to blame. Every soldier in the Israeli army and every officer from the chief of staff down knows that if he opens fire while he himself is not in danger, in danger to his life, he's going to be called to court. And I think that Palestinians, including the top leadership of the PLO, realize that the fact that the Israeli army is a popular army, is a civilian army with so many reservists, older people, serving 1 month a year in the territories all sorts of jobs, was the main reason why the Intifada did not finally deteriorate into a bloodbath, and there was a possibility that this could happen.
My guest is Ehud Ya'ari, and he's Middle East Affairs correspondent for Israel Television and co-author with Zev Schiff of the new book Intifada, the Palestinian Uprising, Israel's Third Front. You suggest that finally the Intifada has helped in its own way to set the stage for some kind of reconciliation between Palestinians and Israelis. What do you think the best hope is?
Well, the best hope is to try and turn the Intifada from a tragedy and the loss of human lives and an ugly event in many ways into an opportunity. The same way that the October War in 73 paved the way to peace between Israel and Egypt, I believe that in the same way the Intifada could serve as the starting point for the slow process of accommodation between Israelis and Palestinians. It depends on both Israelis and Palestinians. I mean, Israelis or Palestinians can make their own decisions, but what is needed here is a realization by both leaderships on both sides of the fence that the Intifada is something that calls for action. Otherwise, I believe that the danger is that Israelis will reach the conclusion that they can live with an ongoing Intifada, and therefore there is no need to do much about the conditions of lives of the Palestinians in the territories, and this would be a grave mistake. At the same time, Palestinians can reach the conclusion that a violent but unarmed struggle was not enough to get the Israelis out or to get the Israelis to sit to the table. And they will draw the conclusion that the next step should be to go back to firearms, terrorism, etc., etc., etc. So the Intifada will not stay as it is. It's a developing, changing war, fascinating in many ways to an outside observer, but very dangerous to people like me who happen to live there.
Do you think it's possible for Israel to be a democracy if it has occupied territories in which the people living there are not treated democratically?
Bluntly, the answer is no. I do believe that if the state of Israel has to impose curfew now and then upon hundreds of thousands of Palestinians for good security reasons, but nevertheless impose curfews, and if we have to keep sending our young soldiers to guard refugee camps and disperse civilian demonstrations, etc., if we will have to keep sending people on administrative detention without trial, without habeas corpus, finally it's going to eat the Israeli democracy from the inside. Many people in Israel are aware of that, and this is why I believe that having the right leadership, most Israelis will give it enough rope to try and get down and sit down with the Palestinians.
Ehud Ya'ari, he's the author with Zev Schiff of the new book Intifada. I'm Terry Grossen, this is Fresh Air. Next time, Wayne Wang, director of the films China's Missing and Dim Sum. His latest movie, Eat a Bowl of Tea, will be shown next week on public television. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In Jessica Hagedorn's new novel, the dictator's wife has about as many shoes as Imelda Marcos. The novel is set in the Philippines, where Hagedorn grew up. Coming up, Hagedorn tells us why leaving the Philippines made her more of a Filipino. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album of works by composer Leon Kirshner. Lloyd says Kirshner's work combines the two major influences of 20th century classical music, Schoenberg and Stravinsky. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews the work of impressionist Louise Duarte, a performer who's her own cast of thousands. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney went to Capitol Hill today to outline cutbacks in four major aircraft programs, including the B-2 stealth bomber, the Pentagon's most expensive and most controversial project. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
Defense Secretary Cheney's proposals represent cuts of about $35 billion over the next 6 years and follow a review of the military's requirements based on changes in the Soviet Union. Cheney said he wasn't ready to kill any of the aircraft programs, but he is willing to reduce or delay them. Cheney argued that cutting the B-2 program from 132 bombers to 75 would shave $14 billion. But House Committee Chairman Aspin noted the price per plane would shoot up even higher, to $800 million. Cheney agreed, but he said the B-2 bomber is the only U.S. bomber capable of evading improving Soviet air defenses. Aspin said these proposals are unlikely to satisfy Congress's appetite for cuts. Cheney promised he would be back with more, suggesting he was ready to eliminate two of the Navy's 14 aircraft carrier battle groups. Earlier this week, an Army official said troop levels could be cut by 250,000. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
U.S. and Soviet trade negotiators meeting in Paris have now reached fundamental agreement on a new trade accord. The trade talks had seemed threatened by the Soviet crackdown on Lithuania. But the talks went ahead after President Bush decided Monday not to impose economic sanctions against the Soviet Union. NPR's John Itzty reports.
The agreement lays the groundwork for greater trade between the two countries, setting up rules to protect patents and copyrights and prohibit dumping of products, among other things. Both sides hope the agreement will be signed at the Washington summit between Presidents Bush and Gorbachev, scheduled to start May 30th. But the agreement doesn't remove high tariffs on Soviet goods coming into the U.S. That will only come with most favored nation status, a status the Soviets were barred from attaining in the 70s because they restricted the emigration of Soviet Jews. President Bush says a new immigration law, now in the Soviet legislature, must be passed before the restriction will be lifted. I'm John Itzty in Washington.
A presidential candidate in Colombia was killed today by machine gun fire on board an airliner that had taken off from Bogota. The gunman was killed by bodyguards for Carlos Pizarro, a former guerrilla leader who had entered the presidential race last month. According to reports, more than 100 people were on board the domestic flight, but no one was injured in the shooting. A phone call to a radio network in Colombia claimed that drug cartels are responsible for the murder. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 10 points to close at 2,676.58 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. To celebrate the recent 70th birthday of composer Leon Kirshner, the Elektra Nonesuch label has released an album of four Kirshner works, performed by the Boston Symphony Chamber Players. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
Leon Kirshner once conducted a concert of what he called divine mutants, classic pieces like the Schumann Fourth Symphony or the Mozart 34th that disobey the old rules. Kirshner's own music doesn't follow the rules either. In the liner notes to a new recording devoted to Kirshner, both John Adams, who is a former student of his at Harvard, and author Joseph Horowitz describe him with the word volatile. Horowitz calls him volatile twice. This word has also turned up in my own Kirchner reviews. He's indeed a mercurial, unpredictable, outspoken individual. His music tends to be knotty and gnarled, but also ripely lyrical and decidedly unacademic. The earliest piece on the new album is a trio for violin, cello, and piano. If you didn't know it was composed in 1954, you'd never guess it's dated that little. The opening movement keeps changing courses, alternating between an internalized rhapsodic lyricism and wild outbursts of energy. The Boston Symphony Chamber Players include Malcolm Lowe, the violinist, cellist Jules Eskin, and pianist Gilbert Kalish, and it sounds like they love Kirchner's music. Lowe and Eskin are also the soloists for Kirchner's Concerto for Violin, Cello, Ten Winds, and Percussion, composed in 1960. Its two cool, spiky movements have a large Stravinskian element. In Kirchner's Music for 12, which was the only chamber piece commissioned by the Boston Symphony for its centennial in 1985, he deliberately uses instruments like the ones in Schoenberg's 1906 Chamber Symphony. Kirchner is one of the few modern composers who has assimilated the two major polarities of 20th century music, Schoenberg, who was one of his teachers at UCLA, and Stravinsky. But what always emerges is Kirchner's own. Schoenberg took his 12-tone system down a path of increasing abstraction and godlike austerity, though his music was also full of sly wit. Kirchner's atonality is more overtly sensuous, more human both in its quirkiness and in its mystery. Alfred Genovesi is the eloquent oboist, with the composer conducting. Kirchner is also an impressive pianist. Try to find his brilliant recording of his own piano concerto. The most recent work on this new album are his five pieces for piano from 1987, an adaptation of his Emily Dickinson song cycle. The fourth piano piece is based on the best-known poem, surely one that Kirchner strongly identifies with. Much madness is divinest sense to a discerning eye. Much sense, the starkest madness. 'Tis the majority in this, as all prevail. Assent, and you are sane. Demur, you're straightway dangerous and handled with a chain. Here's the blazing ending of the final piece. Kirchner's playing has the jazzy freedom and engagement with life that is part of the composer's divinest madness and his starkest common sense.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. Jessica Hagedorn's first novel, Dog Eaters, is set in Manila. The novel spans nearly 30 years, from the late 50s to the early 80s. It's about a dictatorship and about characters who live on fantasies from radio soap operas, American movies, and dance music. Hagedorn was born in the Philippines and came to the U.S. as a teenager in 1963, first to San Francisco and then to New York, where she's been a playwright, performance artist, and poet. I asked her to explain the term dog eaters, the title of her new book.
It's a slang term, sometimes contemptuously used, not just for Filipinos, but I think for many other Asians who, you know, commonly eat dog within the culture. I was inspired by a poem by a Philippine-American poet who lives in New York City. He wrote a poem called The Dog Eater, and it was about an outsider who is shunned by his own villagers and by the villagers in the place where he comes from. And every night he howls at the moon, and he lives on the outskirts of this town. And I was very moved by the image of this man who's forced to sort of live, you know, on the margins. And I thought it was an appropriate image for me. I played around with a lot of different titles, but none of them really struck me as this one did. And I knew it was a risky title, too, because it can be easily misunderstood.
You have a character in your novel who is the dictator's wife, mm-hmm. and in some respects she's not unlike Imelda Marcos. Mm-hmm. For instance, she has a shoe fetish.
Yes.
there's a paragraph about her that I'd like you to read.
Okay. The Manila International Film Festival is the First Lady's latest whim. She orders the city and slums rejuvenated with fresh coats of paint, windows and doorways lined with pots of plastic flowers, the streets swept and reswept by women in red and yellow sweatshirts with Metro Manila Aid printed in big black letters on the back and front. Even Uncle's shack gets the treatment. Funny thing is, it all looks fake. Painted scenery in a slum no one's going to bother visiting. But what the hell? We all get a big bang out of it. Uncle laughs the hardest, shaking his head in disbelief. Crazy bitch, he calls the First Lady. Talagang sirang ulo.
How did the end of the Marcos regime affect your ability to go back home and your eagerness to go back home?
Well,
to visit.
It had profoundly, I think, was a very moving, a profoundly moving experience for a lot of us, and especially Filipino-Americans. We suddenly felt this surge of hope that maybe things really could change, and that you could do it in a semi-peaceful manner, and you could have the whole world sort of suddenly become aware of you in this most positive light. So everyone wanted to go back and sort of witness it for themselves. And I was very sorry I couldn't be there when the actual overthrow happened. But I went home soon afterwards and was sorely disappointed.
In what way were you disappointed?
Well, because I saw that while certain things had changed in terms of, you know, freedom of speech had once again been established. You know, newspapers were once again, you know, able to publish whatever they wanted, and sometimes, you know, in a sort of scandalous manner. I mean, there's a lot of yellow journalism going on. The people's situation, the people who had nothing, it seemed like it had gotten much worse. And the same people were running everything. You know, the same people were in power.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like President Aquino is merely a figurehead. So that was, you know, incredibly painful to a lot of us to see and to sort of have to admit to ourselves that all of that was for nothing in a way.
Were your parents both Filipino?
Yes. They were of mixed blood, but they were they're both Filipino. I consider them Filipino because they've, you know, their parents were both living there. They'd been there. My father's mother, for example, came from another region outside Manila, and even though his father was part Spanish, he was born in the Philippines. So we're mestizo, but we consider ourselves Filipino.
What did your parents do for a living when you were growing up?
My father ran an import-export firm, and my mother was a housewife, his wife. She ran the house.
Was life when you were young a mix of Filipino and American culture?
And Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Very very much affected by, you know, the Spanish culture, and because of my father's Spanish roots. And we were all affected. I mean, you know, my peers, my family, we're all affected by American media, so we were definitely into all the pop culture stuff that came from America.
I could get that sense from your book.
Yeah.
Everybody's always going to the movies and getting really caught up with the movie stars.
Movies and the songs that came to us. Our movies were a little late, and we didn't have television for a long time, for example. But our radio was very current with whatever was going on here. We got immediately in Manila, and so we were always up on all the latest in terms of music. And but we also listened to Philippine music and went to Philippine movies back in those days. So we were sort of, you know, tri-cultural at all times.
How old were you when you moved to the United States?
14.
And you came with your mother?
Yes, and my brothers.
And your father stayed behind?
Yes.
Were your parents separated then?
Yes.
I see.
And we moved to California, and that's where I finished my schooling.
What was the occasion for your moving?
What was the occasion for the moving? My parents separated.
Well, no, I mean, you could have moved to another house.
Oh, no, my mother's very grand, and so, you know, she chose to make this big statement. Also, she had a sister who lived in California, who she hadn't seen in a long time, so it was a chance for her to visit with her and to make this really big move. So that's what we did. My brothers hated it, and they went back. They didn't like the American way of life, but for me, it was liberating.
How so?
Well, I think as a female child, I found the freedoms here that are associated with, you know, just ordinary life, like being able to take a walk by yourself, being able to go to the movies by yourself, being able to take yourself to school and bring yourself home and take public transportation. I mean, things like that that I was not allowed to do alone. Back in the Philippines, you know, I found immensely liberating. And I think it was good for me. I always knew I wanted to write, and I knew that I had to sort of get away from that sheltered environment that I had grown up in.
Why wasn't it acceptable for a girl to take a walk by herself or go to a movie by herself?
Well, I think in the middle to upper classes, it was always this protective environment, especially about female children, you know. Oh, you might get kidnapped. Oh, you know, this watchfulness, this let's keep her a virgin until she's married, chaperones. You know, it's very Catholic in the Philippines. So I see a lot of similarities when I read other novels by Latin Americans, because the girls are, they go to schools run by nuns. The boys go to schools run by Jesuit priests. And it's all very segregated and proper.
When you moved to the States, did you feel that suddenly you were seen by most of the people as a minority?
Oh, well, definitely. Yes.
And how did that change the way you saw yourself or the interactions you had with people?
Well, it politicized me, and it also Filipinized me. A friend of mine who's an actress who's Filipina and has lived here as long as I have told me that the interesting thing for her, and which I found true for myself, was that it took moving here to, you know, to make her see and make her aware of her position in the world and to make her feel more nationalistic about the Philippines. And I found that really true. It was something I had sort of taken for granted, and I assumed people were aware of my culture. And, you know, I kept getting these questions that I found terribly ignorant, like, why do you speak English so well, and where exactly is the Philippines? And one famous writer, as a matter of fact, I met recently, you know, in the last 5 years, so this is not some old story, said to me that she had always known that Filipinos had their children swim from island to island, that we were really good swimmers, and, you know, practically said we had tails and we lived in the trees. And, you know, I'm incredibly ignorant. Really ignorant stuff. So it angered me, and then I realized, you know, that I had to read and find out why so much of my history was suppressed in this country when we knew so much about the West and certainly so much about America.
Do you think that your writing, especially maybe some of your poems, have been influenced by African American writing?
Yes, most definitely. It was when I first came to this country, and I was, you know, still obvious. An adolescent trying to be a writer, a serious writer. You know, I had all these pretentious thoughts about myself. I would experiment and sort of think, here I am writing in English. It's you know, is this really the language of my sort of soul? And I didn't know. And I was listening to a lot of music at that time, and it was sort of my way into the American culture, pop music. And I felt a kinship with black music, and through that language, sort of a cynical, ironic language, and that hipness and that coolness, that ability to withstand pain or endure pain, I started reading a lot of different poets at the time. I was writing a lot of poetry, and the poets I felt the closest to were the poets of color. And I picked up on those rhythms, the street rhythms, and I felt very comfortable writing in that style. And I think that helped open me up. And then I started reading, as I got older, I started reading the works of a lot of Hispanic writers. And also, I really felt a closeness to them because of their traditions, you know, being so similar to mine.
Well, Jessica Hagedorn, thanks a lot for talking with us.
You're very welcome, Terry.
Jessica Hagedorn's novel, Dog Eaters, is published by Pantheon. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we'll be hearing about Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney's testimony on Capitol Hill. The defense secretary today agreed to cut major plans of the Pentagon to acquire new aircraft, including the B-2. It's a big defense cut announced today in a turnabout for the Bush administration's boss of defense. Also, we'll be hearing about the terrible dilemma of Texas migrant workers, farm workers. Last year's harvest was so bad that many don't have enough money to follow the harvest north this year and to try to make some money this time.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Four years ago, Louise Duarte was a California housewife with a good sense of humor. It took a $50 bet with her husband to get her to try stand-up comedy. After a successful debut at L.A.'s Comedy Store, Duarte became a versatile impressionist. She's had a special on Showtime, and she hosts the Rodeo Drive game show on Lifetime. Critic at Large Laurie Stone has been following Duarte's act, an act which includes her impressions of both George Burns and Gracie Allen, as well as Cher and Joan Rivers.
Don't get me started about the Queen. No, 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 no more jokes about the Queen. I think Boy George isn't picked on enough, don't you? But that Fergie, oh, Chubbo, Chubbo, Duchess of Pork. I don't know whether she's from the House of Windsor, the House of Tudor, or the House of Pancakes.
Like other inspired impressionists, oh, Martin Short, Catherine O'Hara, Billy Crystal, Duarte isn't a mimic, but a caricaturist, drawing psychological portraits and satirizing manners. There is something ineffable about her ability to change voice, face, a gorgeous oddness, something in the bones, the lineaments, that comes along once in a blue moon. when her imagination rips, when she free associates and sends her incarnations ricocheting off one another, there's anarchic madness to her work. In her Showtime special, she plays Woody Allen in makeup so exact it attains a surreal edge. He shows a clip from his latest movie, The Incredible Shrinking Shrink, who turns out to be Duart as a doll-sized Dr. Ruth.
So tell me, Woody, have you ever had sex with a fruit?
Sex with fruit?
Yes.
Jeez. You mean like a pomegranate or
no, why not?
Papaya? Or
yes.
A mango?
Of course.
What kind of fruit? You know, from this country or from foreign countries?
Yeah, of course.
Asian, Africa, China.
Why not?
Jeez.
Vegetables, then. You like vegetables, don't you?
Duart's malice is exuberant, not bitter or pinched, because she doesn't target the weak and dispossessed, and she doesn't look down at her subjects. They are her alter egos. Each character expresses a drive. Streisand is narcissism, Cher exhibitionism, Hepburn self-importance. Incorporating, appropriating is the charge that fuels Duart, and she parades this in two of her wildest turns. In her Showtime special, she introduces Rita Mapp, an idiot savant modeled on Dustin Hoffman's character in Rain Man. Rita is a crack impressionist, and as a talk show panel screams out cues, she snaps from bit to bit.
Do that, Midler, Rita!
Yeah, I can do that. Oh, girls, they call me the divine Miss M.
Oh, that's terrific. Can she do Jane Fonda? Do Jane Fonda, Rita.
I want you to stretch and hurt. I want you to feel the burn and the pain. I want you to boycott grapes. Come on, you can do it.
Do Elvis, Rita.
I don't do dead people.
A taped piece Duart screens in her live act is equally self-revealing. A gloss on the impressionist's disposition to seize and possess. She plays Shelley Winters being interrogated by a cop and forced to admit that she ate all of Zsa Zsa Gabor's former husbands. Here, Duart presents the impressionist as cannibal, allowing there is something predatory about the activity, that it involves invasiveness, a plundering of boundaries which women especially have been inhibited from attempting, lest they be deemed witches or masculine females. In front of an audience, Duart gets to be the puppet master as well as all the puppets. She gets to be shameless, bitchy, erotic, flamboyant, intrusive, and egotistical. All of her shows that she loves every minute of it.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic. Louise Duart will be appearing at Harrah's in Atlantic City May 2nd through 14th. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Dan Lachlan, and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the director of Chan is Missing and Dim Sum. Wayne Wang's latest film, Eat a Bowl of Tea, will be shown next week on public television. Also, photojournalist Eugene Richards takes us inside a big city emergency room. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.